in a decrepit Chinese zoo in Changsha. While the planet's only known male giant soft-shell turtle was living in another zoo in Suzhou. And together, this aging pair were the last hope of saving a species believed to be the largest freshwater turtles in the world. Describing the female, Yardley wrote, "She is fed a special diet of raw meat. Her small pool has been encased with bulletproof glass. A surveillance camera monitors her movements. A guard is posted at night. The agenda is simple. The turtle must not die. She is about 80 years old and weighs almost 90 pounds. As for her unlikely would-be lover, he is 100 years old and weighs about 200 pounds. At last report, scientists were going to first try artificial insemination and then, if that failed, place the two of them into the same pool for the spring 2008 mating season." For many Chinese, turtles symbolize health and longevity, Yardley noted. But the saga of the last two Yangtze giant softshells is more symbolic of the threatened state of wildlife and biodiversity in China, where pollution, unbridled hunting, and runaway economic development are destroying habitats and wiping out plant and animal populations with stunning speed. With more and more species threatened with extinction by the flood that is today's global economy, we may be the first generation in human history that literally has to act like Noah to save the last pairs of a wide range of species. Or as God commanded Noah in Genesis, "And of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female." Unlike Noah, though, we, our generation and our civilization, are responsible for the flood, and we have the responsibility to build the ark. We are causing the flood as more and more coral reefs, forests, fisheries, rivers, and fertile soils are spoiled or overwhelmed by commercial development. And only we can build the ark that is needed to preserve them. The beginning of wisdom is to understand that it is our challenge and our responsibility to act like Noah, to create arks, not floods. The energy climate era is about more than just addressing soaring energy demand, drastic climate change, and proliferating petro-dictatorships. It is also about dealing with another effect of a world that is hot, flat, and crowded. The threat to the Earth's biodiversity as more and more plant and animal species are endangered or go extinct. In the past decade, I have traveled throughout the world with Conservation International, which specializes in biodiversity preservation. My wife, Anne, is a member of the CI board, and I frequently call on CI scientists for insight when writing about biodiversity, as I do in this chapter. Species are constantly being discovered, and others are going extinct, either due to biological circumstances or to economic development, hunting, or other human activities. But Conservation International currently estimates that one species is now going extinct every 20 minutes, which is 1,000 times faster than the norm during most of the Earth's history. It is understandably hard to imagine what it means that we humans are causing something in the natural realm to happen 1,000 times faster than normal. That is a big number. Imagine what would happen to us or to our lives and livelihoods and our planet were any other natural rate to be 1,000 times higher today than normal, asked Thomas Brooks, a senior director with Conservation International's Center for Applied Biodiversity Science. What if rainfall were 1,000 times more than normal? We would be flooded. What if snowfall were 1,000 times more than normal? We would never dig out. What if rates of disease transmission for malaria or HIV/AIDS were 1,000 times higher than they are now? Millions would perish. But that is what is happening to plant and animal biodiversity today. This is not just a problem for zoos. We have no idea how many natural cures, how many industrial materials, how many biological insights, how much sheer natural beauty, and how many parts and pieces of a complex web of life we barely understand are being lost. The biodiversity of the planet is a unique and uniquely valuable library that we have been steadily burning down, one wing at a time, before we have even cataloged all the books, let alone read them all, said John Holdren, the Harvard and Woods Hole environmental scientist. Imagine if the trend toward rapid and widespread extinction continues and accelerates. Imagine a world with little or no biodiversity, a stainless steel and cement world stripped bare of every plant and animal, every tree and hillside. Not only would such a world be barely livable from a biological point of view, it would be a world we would barely want to live in. From what landscapes or flower beds would future painters draw their inspiration? What would move poets to write their sonnets, composers to craft their symphonies, and religious leaders and philosophers to contemplate the meaning of God by examining his handiwork up close and in miniature? To go through life without being able to smell a flower, swim a river, pluck the apple off a tree, or behold a mountain valley in spring is to be less than fully alive. Yes, one supposes, we would find substitutes, but nothing that could compare with the pristine bounty, beauty, colors, and complexity of nature, without which we are literally less human. Is it any wonder that studies show that hospital patients who have a view of natural scenery from their rooms recover more quickly? Destroying a tropical rainforest and other species-rich ecosystems for profit is like burning all the paintings of the Louvre to cook dinner, explained the famed entomologist Edward O. Wilson when I visited him in his lab at Harvard, where the walls are lined with drawers and drawers full of the thousands of different ant species that he and his colleagues have collected from across the world. That is what we're doing. We need this money from our oil palm plantations. Sorry about the great forest of Borneo and the orangutans. But for those not persuaded by the aesthetic, elegiac, religious or spiritual values of biodiversity, there are some often overlooked practical benefits to keep in mind. These are known to environmentalists by the rather dry and undescriptive term ecosystem services. Natural ecosystems provide a wide range of benefits and services to people who do not have or cannot afford a local supermarket or plumbing. They supply fresh water, they filter pollutants from streams, they provide breeding grounds for fisheries, they control erosion, they buffer human communities against storms and natural disasters, they harbor insects that pollinate crops or attack crop pests, they naturally take CO2 out of the atmosphere. These services are particularly crucial to poor people in the developing world who depend directly on ecosystems for their livelihoods. Critics of environmentalism usually wave aside the small and the unfamiliar, which they tend to classify into two categories, bugs and weeds, Wilson wrote in The Creation. It is easy for them to overlook the fact that these creatures make up most of the organisms and species on Earth. They forget, if they ever knew, how the voracious caterpillars of an obscure moth from the American tropics saved Australia's pasture land from the overgrowth of cactus, how a Madagascar weed, the rosy periwinkle, provided the alkaloids that cure most cases of Hodgkin's disease and acute childhood leukemia, how another substance from an obscure Norwegian fungus made possible the organ transplant industry, how a chemical from the saliva of leeches yielded a solvent that prevents blood clots during and after surgery, and so on through the pharmacopoeia that has stretched from the herbal medicines of Stone Age shamans to the magic bullet cures of present-day biomedical science. Wild species also enrich the soil, cleanse the water, pollinate most of the flowering plants, They create the very air we breathe. Without these amenities, the remainder of human history would be nasty and brief. If we destabilize nature by degrading it, Wilson continued, the organisms most affected are likely to be the largest and most complex, including human beings. Biodiversity doesn't only help us to live, it helps us to adapt. There is nothing more practical than the role that biodiversity plays in easing adaptation to change for all living things, including us humans. Mark Erdman, a marine biologist with Conservation International in Indonesia, gave me a mini-lecture about this in March 2008 as we sat on a beachfront overlooking the Lombok Strait on the island of Nusa Penida in Indonesia. I had gone there to learn about CI's work to save the diversity of marine life in the Indonesian archipelago. Change is the one constant in life, and without diversity of species, cultures, crops, adaptation to this change becomes much more difficult, Erdman explained. Talk to the farmer who grows just one crop and a disease wipes out his whole farm. Talk to the financial advisor who puts all his money into a single stock. In a nutshell, diversity bequeaths resilience, and we're going to need all the resilience we can muster to deal with the global changes rapidly descending upon us. Who knows what catastrophic diseases lie in wait in our future? If we have plowed up our tropical rainforests for palm oil and sugarcane ethanol, it will be like emptying our toolkit of natural medicines. We need diversity precisely because change is constant, and diversity provides the raw material we need to adapt to change, added Erdman. In a world that is hot, flat, and crowded, where all kinds of things are going to be moving and shifting much faster than in ages past, the last thing we want to lose is the tools we need to adapt to change. When we speak about preserving biodiversity, what exactly does that include? I like the definition offered by the dictionary biologyreference.com, which defines biodiversity as the sum total of life on Earth, the entire global complement of terrestrial, marine, and freshwater biomes and ecosystems, and the species, plants, animals, fungi, and microorganisms that live in them, including their behaviors, interactions, and ecological processes. Biodiversity is also linked directly to the non-living components of the planet: atmosphere, oceans, freshwater systems, geological formations, and soils, forming one great interdependent system, the biosphere. In this whole biosphere, scientists today have discovered and described between 1.7 and 1.8 million species of plants, animals, and microorganisms, says Russell A. Mittermeier, president of Conservation International. But some estimates suggest that the total number of species ranges between 5 and 30 million, and some scientists believe there may be as many as another 100 million species that we just have not identified because they are hidden beneath the earth or seas or in remote locales. Some 80 to 90 new species of primates have been identified in just the last decade and a half, noted Mittermeier, which means that 15 to 20% of all primates have been discovered by science in just the last 15 years. That's why Code Green has to involve both a strategy for the generation of clean energy in order to mitigate climate change and its effects on weather, temperatures, rainfall, sea levels, and droughts, and a strategy for the preservation of the Earth's biodiversity, so we don't also destroy the very plant and animal species that sustain life. Remember, climate change is a critical issue, but biodiversity loss could also destabilize the systemic and vital carrying capacity of our planet as much as climate change. In all the very welcome attention to climate change in recent years, the issue of biodiversity loss has gotten lost. That's why Code Green focuses on both generation of a new kind of energy and preservation of the natural world. Global warming and pollution are just a couple of things that happen when we overtax our natural resources, said Glenn Prickett, Senior Vice President of Conservation International and an expert on economics and the environment. What also happens is that oceans get overfished, forests and coral reefs are destroyed, and this has a real impact, not only on the plants and animals who live in these ecosystems, but also on the people who live off them. We have to consider this problem comprehensively. If the whole world just thinks about halting the emissions of CO2 into the atmosphere and ignores what is happening within our ecosystems, much of the world's biodiversity could be wiped out while we're looking the other way, added Prickett. And don't think for a minute that you can have a healthy climate or a healthy civilization on a dead planet. Our climate is directly impacted by the health of our tropical forests and other natural systems. Over the past decade, I have traveled with Glenn to some of the world's biodiversity hotspots and other endangered regions where CI is working, from the Pantanal wetlands in southwestern Brazil to the Atlantic rainforest on Brazil's coast, from the Guyana Shield forest wilderness in southern Venezuela to the Rio Tambopata Macaw Research Station in the heart of the Peruvian jungle, from the exotic-sounding highland of Shangri-La in Chinese-controlled Tibet to the tropical forests of Sumatra and the coral-ringed islands off Bali in Indonesia. For me, these trips have been master classes in biodiversity, as were my own travels to the Masai Mara in Kenya and the Ngorongoro Crater in Tanzania and the vast empty quarter of the Saudi Arabian desert and, before I had kids, a rappelling trip inside the salt domes of the Dead Sea. In many ways, though, the first trip Glenn and I ever took taught me everything I needed to know about the biodiversity challenge we are facing. In 1998, we went to Brazil, and the trip began with the most unusual interview, location-wise, that I have ever conducted. It was with Nilson de Barros, then superintendent for the environment for the Brazilian state Mato Grosso do Sul, who insisted that we conduct our talk in the middle of the Rio Negro. Mato Grosso do Sul is at the heart of the Pantanal region, along the border between Brazil, Bolivia, and Paraguay. The Pantanal is the largest freshwater wetland in the world, the size of Wisconsin, and is home to jaguar and a host of endangered species. Glenn and I flew in on a tiny prop plane, which landed in the front yard of the Fazenda Rio Negro, a ranch and nature lodge on the Rio Negro. We then boarded motorized launches and set off for the meeting point at a shallow bend in the river. The Pantanal Nature Reserve is Jurassic Park without the dinosaurs. Moving downriver, we passed scores of caimans lounging on the bank, giant river otters bobbing up and down, with egrets, hyacinth macaws, toucans, ibises, marsh deer, spoonbills, jabiru storks, foxes, ocelots, and rheas, relatives of ostriches, all poking their heads through the forest curtain at different points along our route. It was, quite simply, the most stunning cornucopia of biodiversity, plants and animals, that I have ever encountered at one time. De Barros and his team were waiting for us, standing waist-deep in the middle of the Rio Negro. "First a beer, then a bath, then we talk," he said, cracking open a can of Skol as the river flowed by. And I thought I had the best job in the world. The broad threat to biodiversity and ecosystems worldwide today comes from two directions, De Barros explained. The first is from regions where the poorest of the poor are trying to scrape out a living from the natural ecosystems around them. When too many people try to do that, you lose whatever forests, reefs, and species are within reach. That is a huge problem around the Amazon wetlands and rainforest, but not in the Pantanal. The Pantanal, he explained, is not threatened by poor residents who chop down trees and sell them to timber companies to escape from poverty. The culture in the Pantanal is a rare example of man and nature thriving in harmony through a mixed economy of ranching, fishing, and lately, ecotourism. No, the main biodiversity challenge to the Pantanal came from the outside, from globalization. A global triple threat was converging on the Pantanal. Soy farmers on the plateau above the Pantanal Basin, eager to feed a rapidly expanding world soybean market, were widening their fields, and pesticides and silt runoff from their farms were fouling the rivers and wildlife. At the same time, the governments of Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, and Bolivia had formed a trading bloc in the hope of making their economies more globally competitive. To better get the Pantanal's soy products to market, these governments wanted to dredge and straighten the rivers in the area in ways that could greatly alter the ecosystem. Finally, a consortium of international energy companies was building a pipeline across the Pantanal, from natural gas-rich Bolivia to the vast, energy-guzzling Brazilian city of São Paulo. The Pantanal, in fact, is a laboratory of globalization's economic upsides and biodiversity downsides. The biggest upside is that globalization is bringing more people out of poverty faster than ever before in the history of the world. The biggest downside is that, in raising standards of living, globalization is making possible much higher levels of production and consumption by many more people. That's crowded meeting flat. And that, in turn, is fueling urban sprawl around the world, an increase in highways and motorized traffic, and bigger homes with more energy-guzzling devices for more people. To feed this ravenous global economy, more and more companies are tempted to take over vast native forests in places like Indonesia and Brazil and convert them to oil palm plantations, soybean farms, and other large-scale commercial enterprises at a speed and scope the world has also never seen before. Over the years, Glenn Prickett explains, NGOs like Conservation International, the Nature Conservancy, and the World Wildlife Fund have developed tools and large-scale education campaigns that can help the rural poor live more sustainably and preserve the very natural systems on which they depend. But we have not yet developed the tools and scale of operation to meet the globalization threat to biodiversity, which is becoming overwhelming, he explained. To be sure, in recent years, we've seen many collaborations between conservation groups and global companies like Walmart, Starbucks, and McDonald's, which aim to show these companies how to reduce the impact their supply chains and manufacturing processes have on the natural world. But all their efforts are just fingers in the dike. Global growth is driving up commodity prices, prompting companies to put more land under agricultural cultivation for food, fiber, and biofuels, and stimulating demand for more tropical forests to be stripped of timber, more coral reefs to be lost to destructive fishing practices, and more mines to be dug for minerals. Without governments that are highly attentive to where and how lands are developed, and able to restrain the pressures from the global marketplace, the growth pressures from a world getting flat and crowded at the same time could simply overwhelm the world's last remaining biodiversity-rich forests and reefs, which will only make the world hotter, because deforestation accounts for some 20% of all CO2 emissions. In the same 20 minutes that will see some unique species vanish forever, Conservation International notes, 1,200 acres of forests will be burned and cleared for development. The CO2 emissions from deforestation are greater than the emissions from the world's entire transportation sector. All the cars, trucks, planes, trains, and ships combined. Less forest cover means fewer acres of habitat for species, so they must move or adapt. Those that can, survive. Those that cannot, go extinct. It's that simple, only it is now happening faster than ever in more places than ever. This is why we need a strong ethic of conservation. There have to be limits to how much and where we encroach on the natural world. Without such limits, we will see the living and nesting areas of more and more species paved over, rivers fouled, corals bleached, and forests plowed under for industrial agriculture. We will continue to lurch from single-issue response to single-issue response without ever developing a systematic approach that can marry global growth and biodiversity protection. It starts with connecting the dots. To help cut emissions and boost energy security, the entire European Union has set the target of producing 20% of its energy from renewable sources by 2020, including increased use of biofuels, transportation fuels derived either from crops like corn, oil palm, soybeans, algae, or sugarcane, or from plant waste, wood chips, or wild grasses like switchgrass. The EU has declared that the bio-ingredients of biofuels sold in Europe, palm oil and corn, for example, must not come from tropical forests, nature reserves, wetlands, or grasslands with high biodiversity. But fuels are fungible in a world market and are not always easy to monitor. It is hard to believe the EU mandate about renewable fuels will not accelerate the conversion of rainforests in Southeast Asia to oil palm plantations. Some say it already has. Palm oil is the most efficient base for biodiesel fuel, although it is also used for cosmetics and in cooking. The cruel irony is that deforestation will result in more greenhouse gases being released into the atmosphere than the use of biofuels will eliminate. I have flown over an oil palm plantation in North Sumatra in Indonesia. It looked like someone laid down 25 football fields in the middle of a tropical forest, just one rectangular block after another. Michael Grunwald wrote a piece for Time, March 27, 2008, in which he described flying over a similar plantation in Brazil with an eco-activist. From his Cessna a mile above the southern Amazon, John Carter looks down on the destruction of the world's greatest ecological jewel. He watches men converting rainforest into cattle pastures and soybean fields with bulldozers and chains. He sees fires wiping out such gigantic swaths of jungle that scientists now debate the savannization of the Amazon. Brazil just announced that deforestation is on track to double this year. Carter, a Texas cowboy with all the subtlety of a chainsaw, says it's going to get worse fast. "It gives me goosebumps," says Carter, who founded a nonprofit to promote sustainable ranching on the Amazon frontier. "It's like witnessing a rape." Carter adds, "You can't protect it. There's too much money to be made tearing it down," he says. "Out here on the frontier, you really see the market at work." The numbers tell the story. Our planet is 4 billion years old, and life has existed on Earth for a little more than 2 billion years. Over those 2 billion years, there has been a very, very slow, normal pace of extinctions. On average, a species might live for 1 million years, then go extinct. That very gentle, very slow background rate of extinctions has been punctuated over the centuries by five massive catastrophic extinction events that have led to the loss of an extremely high proportion of our planet's life at different periods. The most recent mass extinction, said Thomas Brooks, the Conservation International biodiversity expert, was about 65 million years ago. The mass extinction of the dinosaurs, apparently due to an asteroid smashing into the Yucatan Peninsula in what is now Mexico. That asteroid is believed to have expelled a thick dust cloud into the atmosphere, which apparently triggered global cooling and ended up starving a large proportion of the Earth's plants and animals. When one looks at more recent history, the last tens of thousands of years that humans have been on Earth, one finds localized wide-scale extinctions as human groups moved from place to place, from the Polynesians in Hawaii to Indonesian seafarers on Madagascar to our Pleistocene predecessors who walked across the land bridge that existed in what is now the Bering Strait at least 12,000 years ago and wiped out many of the large mammals of North America, including the woolly mammoths and saber-toothed tigers. As we enter the modern age, though, the impact of globalization is metastasizing to cause what is already being called the Earth's sixth great mass extinction. This is not a local extinction event anymore. It is unfolding at a scale equal to the asteroid or the impacts of the rest of our planet's five mass extinctions, as best we can measure from the fossil record, Brooks said. We are the flood. We are the asteroid. We had better learn how to be the Ark. For more than 40 years now, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature has tracked the status of the world's biodiversity and assessed the probability of extinction of every known plant and animal species. Its red list of threatened species monitors current extinctions and gives us a picture of what is happening right now. What we learn from the IUCN Red List is that when mass human-driven extinctions happened in places like the Hawaiian Islands after the arrival of the Polynesians around AD 400, they were closed-system extinctions, terrible in themselves, but confined to those regions, said Brooks. But due to globalization, we are now seeing extinctions that used to be isolated to one island or region happening all over the world at the same time. We know that we can restore natural habitats, said Brooks. We know that we can restore populations in order to bring back species whose survival is threatened, like the buffalo. We know that we can clean up pollution, even a river as polluted as the Thames. It is even within our grasp to reverse climate change, he added. But extinctions are irreversible. Jurassic Park is a fiction. Once a species is gone, it is lost forever. We have lost that million years of our planetary heritage forever. Later is over. As many beautiful things as there are to behold in the rainforest, I actually prefer the sounds to the sights. In June 2006, Glenn, my family, and I went by riverboat up Peru's Rio Tambopata to visit a CI-sponsored research station that specializes in rescuing scarlet macaws. I like to lie awake inside a mosquito net and listen to the rainforest symphony outside. It sounded like one of those dissonant pieces of modern music, a cacophony of birds, red howler monkeys, wild pigs, frogs, and insects making bizarre clicks, snorts, croaks, chirps, wails, and whistles that sound like car alarms, strange doorbell chimes, and an orchestral wind section that had lost its music but was playing on anyway. Occasionally, this symphony would get punctuated by the shrill, desperate scream of a member of the human species in our lodge who had just encountered a spider in the toilet. The stretch of Amazon rainforest we were visiting in southern Peru is a largely uninhabited, by humans, wilderness that is home to some of the planet's most endangered wildlife and one of the world's largest macaw clay licks, a cliff of red clay where blue, red, and gold macaws flock for a dirt breakfast every morning. Look down in the rainforest and you might see a hunting wasp stinging a caterpillar and depositing its eggs inside. Look up in the verdant canopy and you will see the hanging nest of the Oropendula weaver birds. You will notice, though, that the Oropendulas have located their nest on a branch right next to a large white wasp's nest. Why? So if any predators try to attack the birds, they will also rile the wasps, an ingenious natural security system. Look around, though, and you will see trouble looming. Going up the Rio Tambopata on our riverboat, we saw gold miners using big motorized barges and mercury to dredge and sift and destroy riverbanks in search of gold. With global gold prices soaring, the incentives to dredge the Tambopata are enormous. Some of the miners clear forests for camps and hunt rare animals for food. And access is getting easier by the week. The interoceanic highway running from the Atlantic coast of Brazil to the Pacific coast of Peru is nearing completion. More roads lead to more agriculture, more logging, more mining, and more oil and gas extraction, which converts more forests to cropland, which releases more climate-changing greenhouse gases as millions of trees are cut down. That whole scene reminds me of the Weather Channel climatologist Heidi Cullen's remark that we humans are now playing lead electric guitar in Mother Nature's symphony orchestra. In doing so, we forget a fundamental truth. We are the only species in this vast web of life that no animal or plant in nature depends on for its survival. Yet we depend on this whole web of life for our survival. We evolved within it. As we adapted to it, it shaped us into what we are. We humans need that web to survive. It doesn't need us, but we sure need it, and it thrives only if the whole system works in harmony. That is why, at the end of the day, this biodiversity issue is not just about saving nature. It is equally about saving humanity, says Edward O. Wilson. It is about understanding who we are as a species and deciding how we intend to continue living on this planet and relating to its natural environment. Without the biosphere that made us what we are, in which we evolved, we are not fully human, Wilson explained as we sat in his laboratory at Harvard. The more we change the climate and the natural world by our actions, he added, the more we eliminate the plants and animals, forests, rivers, oceans, and glaciers that regulate life on the planet to the great benefit of human beings for free. The more we humans are going to have to try to regulate everything ourselves. And anyone watching the political debates about climate change should be very, very wary about our ability to manage things as well as Mother Nature has done. The more we destroy the natural world, said Wilson, the more we have to take over and employ our own ingenuity to maintain it moment by moment all by ourselves. So unless we plan to change Earth literally into a spaceship in which our hands are on the controls, moment by moment, all of the necessities of human life, where we manage the atmosphere moment by moment, then we better make sure we return the maintenance of the biosphere back to where it started and belongs, and where these millions of species support us cheerfully, scot-free. Mindlessly degrading the natural world the way we have been is no different than a bird degrading its own nest, a fox degrading its own den, a beaver degrading its own dam. We can't keep doing that and assume that it is just happening over there. The scale of biodiversity loss happening today is having global impacts. As the team at Conservation International likes to say, lost there, felt here. And we can't keep doing that and assume that we will repair it later. Later is over. That is the psychological biodiversity red line we have passed as we entered the energy climate era. Later was a luxury for previous generations, eras, civilizations, and epochs. It meant that you could paint the same landscape, see the same animals, eat the same fruit, climb the same trees, fish the same rivers, enjoy the same weather, or rescue the same endangered species that you did when you were a kid, but just do it later, whenever you got around to it. Nature's bounty seemed infinite, and all the threats to it either limited or reversible. In the energy climate era, given the accelerating rates of extinction and development, later is going to be removed from the dictionary. Later is no longer when you get to do all those things in nature you did as a kid, on your time schedule. Later is when they're gone, when you won't get to do any of them ever again. Later is too late. So whatever we are going to save, we'd better start saving now.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.